Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last year, after experiencing the highest number of homicides since 1993, Charlotte City Council decided to alter the city's approach to violent crime and crimes committed with guns. Instead of merely applying a get-tough policy, they will now approach this epidemic as a public health crisis. After identifying crime hotspots, CMPD, the mayor, and council plan to use this information as an epidemiologist might, pinpointing crime in these areas and tracking it back to its source. If you do that, they believe, you will come away with an understanding of the root causes and be able to begin treating the disease, eliminating the problem. Treating crime as a public health crisis has been done elsewhere with success. And one of the organizations involved, Cure Violence, has made notable progress in West Garfield Park, one of Chicago's most violent communities. Charlie Ransford is Senior Director of Science and Policy for Cure Violence Global, and he joins us this morning by phone from Grand Rapids, Michigan, where it's very cold, I'll bet you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks very much for having me.
You're welcome. And here in our Spirit Square studios, Malcolm Graham, who represents District 2 on Charlotte City Council. Welcome back.
Good morning.
And Dr. David Jacobs is here. He's Medical Director of Trauma Services for Atrium Health and a trauma surgeon at F.H. Sammy Ross Jr. Trauma Center at Carolinas Medical Center. He's on the front lines of dealing with the targets of crime. Welcome back to you, too.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Nice to have you here. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Charlie, let me begin with you. You're at the forefront of advancing a national effort. In fact, it's an international effort to create this public health framework around violence prevention. Where did the idea for approaching it this way come from?
Well, the approach started with Dr. Gary Slutkin, who is an epidemiologist, and he actually started his career dealing with the more traditional epidemic diseases that we're familiar with. He started with tuberculosis in San Francisco, and then he quickly moved in the mid-80s to Africa and worked on a number of epidemics, including HIV/AIDS, cholera, and tuberculosis. And what happened, actually, was he was taking a break from the epidemics that he was dealing with. He came back to his hometown of Chicago, and Chicago was in the midst of a very violent year that when he came back in 1995. And what he was seeing was he was looking at the charts, he was reading the news articles, he was looking at the graphs of the violence, and he was seeing the exact same charts and maps and graphs that he would see for epidemic diseases. And so he quickly, just by looking at the data, realized that this looked like an epidemic problem. And so he came up with the idea of just using basically the same exact techniques that he used for these other epidemic diseases to use on this epidemic problem of violence. And so that first program started in Garfield Park in Chicago. It was at the time the most violent community in Chicago. And that first year we got a 67% drop in shootings in 2000. And so we quickly realized that this, you know, could work, that the same approach could work. And that's when we began expanding in Chicago, and eventually we expanded to other cities around the U.S. and internationally.
I know you're on the same page with this idea, Dr. Jacobs, but what techniques, what tools, how would an epidemiologist approach an outbreak of disease, and how does that apply?
Well, let me first start by saying that I'm not an epidemiologist.
I know.
But I understand your question, and using public health principles means that you focus on the disease as opposed to focusing on the individual. And I think for too long we've said this is an individual, this is a personal responsibility, behavioral issue, whereas the public health approach really looks upstream to find the root causes of violence. And there are many, many forms of violence, but also many causes of
interpersonal. But don't we know them already?
We know some of it. And I'm glad you asked that question, because there has been a significant hindrance, cap, if you will, on us understanding the disease of violence because of legislation that occurred 20 years ago that really put a freeze on us being able to understand this. Had we been able to do the level of research that we put into HIV and other diseases, we'd be much, much, much farther ahead in understanding the disease, understanding the causes, risk factors, protective factors, and how we can best treat it. And so, given that, we don't have all the information that we need. That doesn't mean that we need to wait until we have all that information, but you need that evidence to figure out where the problems are and then to figure out what works and then to spread that to a larger scale population.
What was that legislation that prohibited you or prevented
there was a, there was legislation that was actually added on to some other bills in the early part of this century, 1990s, I guess, that essentially said that that the government could not conduct any research that had anything to do with gun violence. And even though it was not as narrow as some people will tell you, it really had a chilling effect on violence in general. And so it really depended upon private corporations, private funding, academic institutions to come up with the money to try to figure out how we were going to solve this problem. Fortunately, CDC and NIH has recently agreed to fund $50 million towards gun violence research, and so hopefully some of these answers will be forthcoming. But again, we are much farther behind than we should be.
So, Malcolm Graham, you're on City Council, and the mayor's been on this program to talk about this. A couple of weeks ago she was on. It was right after the police department released the hotspot information, the four hotspots around Charlotte where the most crimes occur, in particular where the most homicides occur and acts of physical violence occur. And I got to be honest, I had trouble understanding how this worked or how this might work going forward. Do people on council fully understand it?
I think we do. I think we are following the mayor's lead in terms of trying to use data and how we analyze that data to lead us into different approaches for working with the Charlotte McMurray Police Department to solve the crime. Certainly, this is a marathon, not a sprint, in terms of how we collect the data, analyze the data, interpret the data, and then put policies in place. But certainly, we have to look at a holistic approach in terms of what's happening on the ground.
So we knew about these hotspots. These are not new places.
Nothing new there.
So what, prior to this new approach, what did we do with that information? Just go out there and round people up and put them in jail when we could?
I think we operated in silos, right? Because a lot of the services that the city provides, i.e. where law enforcement, mental health and drunk counseling and poverty issues are county issues, and I think we worked in silos. Now there is a collaboration between the city and the county manager, the city manager, the mayor, the chairman of the board of county commissioners are all working together now collectively to merge the data, to merge the services, i.e. I would like to see in some cases where a police officer shows up, there's someone from social service showing up, because some of the indicators that we see that lead to violent crime in our community are, you know this as well, unemployment, poverty, code violations, requests for services for 311 educational levels. So it's a blending of the two in terms of strong law enforcement as well as the social aspect perspective of it, which is a county service. Therefore, again, city, county needs to work together, merge the data, analyze the data, and interpret the data and put responsible policies in place. Again, this is a marathon solution, not a sprint.
As you mentioned, Charlie Ransford, this effort, this new approach, started in Chicago. How long ago did it start there in Chicago in the West Garfield Park area?
The first program in Chicago was implemented in 2000, and then we started replicating in other communities in 2008. We actually started two programs in Iraq at that time. We had programs in Iraq for 4 years, and then we also started in Baltimore. And at this point in time, we're in about 25 U.S. cities and another about a dozen cities around, mostly in Latin America and a few in the Middle East, Africa, and Europe as well.
So how many crimes or homicides are committed in Chicago at large or in West Garfield Park before you got there and before you began this approach? Because your success there has been talked about a lot. So how many were being committed before you started?
Boy, I have to look at the actual chart, so I'm really drawing on my memory here, the specific numbers, because as I said, we're in like, you know, 40-some communities. And so, but my memory is like we had about in the mid-40s number of shootings. It was like 46, 47 shootings, and that went down to single digits in within 1 year. And actually, the impact happens within the first few months. And so, I totally understand that there are a lot of long-term issues, education, jobs. But when we're dealing with like the most violent people, we can actually go and identify the people that are most likely to be violent, and we could start working with them today, and we could start diverting them to more positive outcomes today. And so when we work in a community, we often see that 50, 60% drop within the first couple of months, and that is sustained throughout the first year.
So you're working in Chicago, Baltimore, New York City, New Orleans, Oakland, Puerto Rico, and other cities around the country, also in other countries. Have you had similar experience to what you experienced in Chicago in those areas?
We have a very consistent result, which is when you implement according to the model, you get results, and you get them within the first few months. And those results are in the realm of 40 to 60% drops in shootings and killings. And now we've had some areas, some communities that have gone a year or 2 years without a shooting or a homicide. And so we focus in on the most violent community, the hot spots of a city, and that particular community can go for a year or 2 years without a shooting. And the reason for that is because we're hiring workers who are from the community who know who are involved. They know the people, they know the places. And they hear about what happened last night or what's about to happen tonight. And so they can get in there and really interrupt things because they know what's going on. And so you really, when you just put the people in place that know what's going on and you train them to be able to do what is needed to do to stop the violence, they can be extremely effective. And sometimes a community can go without violence for long periods of time.
So last year in Charlotte, there were 107 homicides in 2019. But as we discussed earlier this week with CMPD Chief Kirk Putney, for every homicide last year, there were three additional non-fatal shootings, and Atrium Health reports an increase in stab wounds as well, and aggravated assaults have also risen. And Dr. Jacobs, you're on the front lines of trying to save lives when they come into the hospital as a result of these violent acts. What kinds of injuries are you seeing?
Well, we're seeing injuries across the board. We're seeing stab wounds, we're seeing gunshot wounds, but we're seeing traditional, if you will, hand-to-hand combat. I think most of the programs that people talk about now are really related to firearm injury, because we know that the firearm is the most lethal mechanism, the most lethal vector through which this disease is transmitted. If there's a disagreement and someone stabs somebody, the likelihood of that person surviving is much higher than if that person gets shot. But as you mentioned, we're seeing increases in all forms of violence, domestic violence, youth violence, child abuse, all forms of violence. And, you didn't ask this question, but I can't help but think that this is somehow related to the social mobility issues that Charlotte has. I think we would be naive to think that those two issues, Charlotte being number 50 of 50 in terms of social mobility, that those two issues, that issue and the homicide violence issue in Charlotte, are unrelated.
Another reason to why we should look at this as a public health issue is because of what happens to some of these people when they come to you and other hospitals. Because we're picking up the tab, and some of these injuries are outrageous. They're like, as you say, wartime injuries. We'll talk about that a little bit when we come back in just a moment on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about approaching violent crime, particularly homicides or the use of guns, as a public health issue and using the the tools that would be in an epidemiologist's doctor's bag to do so. Charlie Ransford is the Senior Director of Science and Policy for Cure Violence Global. They started in Chicago. They're all over the world, and they've had great success at doing what we're trying to do here. He joins us by phone. Malcolm Graham from District 2, Charlotte City Council, is with us here in the studio, and Dr. David Jacobs is also here, Medical Director of Trauma Services at Atrium Health and a trauma surgeon at the F.H. Sammy Ross Trauma Center at Carolina's Medical Center. We spoke about this briefly with Police Chief Kerr Putney earlier this week, Dr. Jacobs, but Atrium Health has reported that some of the victims that come in with these gunshot wounds suffer amputations and injuries that will prevent them from walking. Some will be on ventilators for the rest of their lives, and worse. Who pays for this?
Well, we all pay for this. And you know, those are very easy, well, those are relatively easy numbers to try to get in terms of employability, in terms of lifelong disability. But one of the things that we're now beginning to recognize is the psychological impact of violence, not just on the victim, but on the families,
yes,
on the communities, on us as a city. PTSD is rampant in the post-trauma patient and family population, and we're now just beginning to understand that it's important to provide wraparound services to those, to that patient population as well. Many of these patients don't have health insurance, and so at the end of the day, we're all paying that bill. And so it just makes so much more sense to invest pennies in prevention rather than spending dollars at the end of the day in terms of taking care of these injuries lifelong.
America does not have a good track record of taking putting money into prevention. We seem to be more of a let's punish them society, or when you get really sick, we'll take care of you, if it's an illness that we're talking about. Politically, how does this play, Malcolm? Because that get tough seems to be what works politically.
Well, it works in the short term, right, in terms of heavy law enforcement focused primarily, i.e., on a hot spot like Bayswater, Roland LaSalle Street. We can go in there and we can have mass police penetration. We can clean up the area. But where do the people go? Where do those individuals who are drug dependent, who are lingering on the corner, where do they go when we clean it up? Where do we go? How do we provide the services that someone who is homeless, when we clean that area up, where do we send them? So there's a wide variety, I think the doctor's right, in terms of the wraparound services that the city, the county has to provide through public policy and be intentional about it. We aren't intentional about it right now.
Is it less expensive to provide prevention services and do some of the things that we'll talk in some depth with Charlie Ransford about in terms of how you get a handle on crime before it happens? Or is it less expensive to provide the psychological counseling and the medical care that is needed in the case of shootings that do occur?
I would hate to have to make the choice between the two. I mean, I think we need both. I think we understand that communities that have high incidences of violence have large percentage of folks who suffer from PTSD, not from being shot themselves, but from hearing sirens and gunshot wounds and knowing family members. When I go into the schools and talk to these kids about violence, I ask them, how many of you know somebody who's been shot or stabbed? Almost every kid raises their hands. And so this is a disease that spreads. But more importantly, once you have that PTSD, you're more likely, yeah, to become a violent perpetrator. And so it can't be one or the other. We have to address the mental health issues, but we have to address the social structural issues in communities that lead to violence.
Question from Pete on Twitter for Dr. Jacobs. As the only level one trauma center in Charlotte, what are the survival trends from gunshot victims at Atrium over the last 18 months? Do you know?
Our overall trauma mortality is probably around 4 to 5%. We are one of the largest trauma centers in the country, and that 4 to 5% mortality rate is pretty much what the best trauma centers in the country are achieving.
Why are we one of the largest in the country? Because we need it?
Well, because we need it, but because of how we're located. There are no other level one trauma centers within 80 to 90 miles. We serve Charlotte metro region, but we also serve South Carolina and some of the more rural areas because of the helicopters that we have. So we just have a large patient population.
And Nelson on Twitter asks about Chicago, Charlie Ransford. We hear every day, he writes, about the huge number of shootings and murders in Chicago. If your program is so effective, why not implement it throughout that city? Why is it just in pockets?
Well, that's a great question, and I think I would give that question to the lawmakers in Chicago and in the state of Illinois. And I think what you see is the lawmakers in Illinois are realizing this. And the Mayor Lightfoot in Chicago just recently announced funding of $7 million for basically the cure violence approach, although it's going to be implemented by people that are our friends and people that we trust to do the work, but independent from us. And so, yeah, they are looking to do that. And other cities are looking to go citywide, too. New York City started off as one program area in Crown Heights in Brooklyn, and now they have a $30 million program that goes across most of the city. St. Louis is another example of a smaller city that they're just starting off, but they have $7 million that they're going to try to go as far citywide as they can. And I think what these cities are recognizing is, you can do as much as you can on policing. And believe me, these cities have done as much as they can on policing and trying to discourage violent behavior. But punishment does not work as well in discouraging behavior as it does coming from a friend or coming from somebody you trust and is credible to you. And you could think about, Alcoholics Anonymous or Weight Watchers or other types of behavior change interventions. And really, they come from people that are credible and rather than from punishment. And I think that's what people are realizing. That's what city leaders are realizing, including in Chicago. They're realizing that this other approach can actually be more effective in discouraging violent behavior.
Dr. Jacobs, you told NBC Charlotte that this disease of violence affects specific patient populations. What does that mean?
Well, this is like any other disease. And when we look at diseases, we look to see whether there are populations at risk. We know that the homicide rate for African-American males of color is as high as 10 times what it is for white males. And so there's got to be a reason for that. It's not a genetic predisposition. It's because of the socioeconomic impact of the communities in which they live. And so if we had a disease that was impacting a segment of the population that was that out of bounds compared to the norm, we would all be running around with our hair on fire saying, what can we do? But we just know, and that's just for males. Same trend exists for females. If you're a person of color, more likely male than female, you are much more likely to become a victim of violence.
Wow. Cure Violence says, Malcolm, that, and others say this too, that violence is contagious, just like a disease. CMPD Chief Kerr Putney talked about it earlier this week. You lost your sister to a shooter at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston. These mass shooters often seem to be imitating their predecessors, or certainly putting those predecessors up for hero worship. That's one way this seems to be contagious. How does it work on a one-to-one level in a neighborhood where it's just no one's going in there with hateful feelings about racial inequality, but they're using a gun to solve a petty argument?
Very good question. I think it's because, as the doctor indicated, it's just socioeconomics, peer groups. When you see your peer, your neighbor, someone in your classroom settle disputes that way, and they run in your circle, your group, you are more likely to imitate that type of behavior. And so when you have pockets of poverty, when you have pockets of individuals who are in need of higher education, when you have pockets of unemployment, and when you have pockets of poverty, the behavior tends to duplicate itself and multiply among itself, among the people within that population. And so we have to be, again, very intentional, not about going into hotspots and policing the area, but very intentional about going in those same hotspots and identifying the preschools, the elementary schools, the high schools, and providing some services for those individuals.
How much of this contagion, do you think, is driven by the fact that you might have a gun, therefore I need to get one?
Well, I think that's the tough guys, right? When I was growing up,
I'm not even sure that's tough. That's self-preservation. You might have one, therefore I need one.
Well, Yeah, no. When I grew up, we settled fights sometimes, you know, with fists. Now these guys, as you indicated, are resorting to a gun, which is readily available. You can buy one simply on any street corner if you look hard enough, yeah. Illegally. There's no registration for it. There's no background checks for it. Some people believe in those communities that they need self-protection, so I agree with that point. And so it's, but we can't not live in a society or a city where it's the Wild Wild West. And that's why it's so important that city, through policies and being very intentional, go into these communities and work collaboratively with the county. Certainly the Charlotte Mecklenburg School plays a huge role in this as well. Right. But more importantly, our faith organizations, our community organizations, this is a community-wide problem. That's why we go back to the topic of the day, that this is a public health crisis, right? Everyone needs to be on deck and involved.
Charlie Ransford, talk about the contagion aspect of this. What factors seem to drive this contagion? Is it just because it's become more socially acceptable to solve problems with a gun in certain communities, or is there something else at play?
I mean, certainly peers play a big role. Peer pressure in how you respond. In the communities where violence is rampant, what you have is you have a code of the street, is what they call it. It's a where if you don't respond to certain situations with violence, you then are seen as weak. You then are seen as potentially a target. And so this is the way in which violent behavior is encouraged and the way it spreads, one of the ways. But another way is just through exposure to violence itself. And so, you know, we've talked a little bit about the trauma from exposure to violence, but it's important to look at the symptoms of PTSD. These symptoms include aggression, increased aggressiveness, increased reactivity to small cues, to small slights that you might get. You know, these types of reactions that you get from being traumatized by violence actually make you much more likely to react violently to something that happens to you. And this is going largely untreated in violent communities. So you have in these communities, like as we've said, a lot of the children have been exposed to violence. They know somebody shot. Many of them have seen somebody shot or killed. And yet their trauma is going untreated. And so they have these symptoms of PTSD. They have this increased aggressiveness. What we have in the community is essentially an uncontrolled, untreated epidemic that's being allowed to just spread throughout the community. And so you have young children who are being exposed and traumatized to violence, becoming more aggressive and becoming more reactive because of that, becoming more sensitive. And then you have peer pressure telling them that they need to react violently to certain situations. And I think that the behavior is actually quite predictable. And so what we do is we just treat it as an epidemic. We send workers in there to interrupt that transmission, to stop that individual from who we know has been highly traumatized. We stop that individual from reacting in ways that are aggressive, and we help them to get treatment so that they can no longer be as aggressive as they were before.
We've just done these hotspot studies, Doctor, in Charlotte, and we knew about these locations already, but these are the places where most of the crime occurs. And it's a very small geographic part of Charlotte. When you put all these places together, I think it's 8% of the population or the landmass of Charlotte. I've forgotten the exact number. But you say that labeling communities as high crime is not helpful for the cause. Why?
Well, I don't want my words to be taken out of context.
Okay.
And I guess I would say I think it's important from a science perspective to understand the communities and the risk factors and the resilience factors that exist within those communities. I think the point that I was trying to make is that I think that targeting specific communities, particularly as we do that with our public information systems, tends to label these communities as, well, that's where the problem is. And so we end up finger pointing when this is really a community written, you know, in capitals, a community problem. Charlotte has a violence problem. And that problem may be on Beatty's Ford Road, but it also may be in Ballantyne. And I think when we say, well, there's a hot spot here, the folks in Ballantyne or the folks in Myers Park may say, well, that's not my problem. And so, you know, my My thesis has always been that everybody in the community has a role to play in this issue of violence prevention, and I fear that if we begin singling out communities, that people then become disengaged because they say, well, it's not happening in my community, it's not my problem.
How do you do that? How do you get some, I don't mean to pick on Myers Park, but you brought it up, but how do you get somebody who's not affected by violence, no matter where they live, to be involved?
Well,
and what do you want them to do?
I think that the first thing to get them to realize is that they are affected by violence. You know, if you're a business person, you have a small business, or you're thinking about relocating to Charlotte, you pick up the newspaper and say, they had 107 homicides this year. Is that really where I want to relocate my business to? If I want to go to this store in this particular area, if I want to go to this mall where this shooting happened a couple of weeks ago, am I really going to do that? And so it affects all of us in ways that we can't necessarily measure, but are clearly there. And so
What do you want them to do?
Well, there are so many things that we can do. I think the Cure Violence model is one of them, but there are many long-term structural things. We talked about the Upward Mobility Project, mentoring, early childhood education, all of those things. And it may take a generation to turn that ship around, but all of those things have been shown to contribute to decreased violent activity over years, over decades, over generations. And so finding out what works and bringing those kinds of interventions to scale that everybody feels comfortable, everybody wants to get involved with, I think is a possibility.
Experiencing violence directly, being around people who have experienced violence, living in an area that is prone to violent activity, is causing this traumatization of a lot of people and the PTSD you referred to in a lot of people. And what it seems like, Charlie, is that this is very similar to breaking the cycle of domestic violence. You have to start somewhere and change reactions. Is that what we're talking about here?
Well, all violence is related. And, I mean, we have this tendency to talk about, you know, community violence and domestic violence and suicide and other types of violence separately, but these are all related. And, for instance,
I've got 30 seconds.
The people that we work with in Chicago, we think of them as involving community violence. 100% of them have violence in their home. And so the violence that we see pouring out in the community, a lot of it starts in the homes, and that's why people are reacting violently. And so we need to be thinking violence overall as contagious.
Okay, let me stop you there because I got to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the things that you do with Cure Violence.
Hey, y'all, this is Tommy Tomlinson. On this week's episode of Southbound, we talked to Patterson Hood of the Drive-By Truckers. The rock band has a new album called The Unraveling that comes out next week. You can find this and every episode of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and WFAE.org.
Support for Southbound comes from Southeast Radiation Oncology Group.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about violence and curing violence by treating it as a public health crisis. In going after it as an epidemiologist would an epidemic. Malcolm Graham is here, City Council District 2. They have made this decision along with the mayor and the police department to approach it this way. Dr. David Jacobs is the medical director of trauma services at Atrium Health and a trauma surgeon at Carolinas Medical Center. And Charlie Ransford joins us from Grand Rapids, Michigan. He's the senior director of science and policy at Cure Violence Global. They've had a lot of success in approaching this way in some of the most violent areas of cities around this country and in other countries. Charlie, Cure Violence has this three-step strategy in approaching violence as a disease, the first of which is to detect and interrupt conflicts. Violence is often random and completely unpredictable. So how do you accomplish that?
Well, I think that's a fallacy. I think people think of violence as unpredictable and random, but if you're in the community, you know something. You know the people that are most likely to be violent. And I think all of us can relate to this in our own lives. Like, we know the people in our lives who are most likely to be violent. And I think, you know, people in communities that are violent, they similarly know the people in the community most likely to be violent. And furthermore, you know the places where the violence is most likely to occur, the corners, the street corners, the parks, the liquor stores. And you also sometimes can even know the event. You know, maybe there's somebody being released from prison that might be causing some problems. Maybe there was a party last night that you could hear about what happened and there's an argument. Maybe somebody got robbed. There are a lot of predictors of violence. The problem is we're not picking up on them. We're not paying attention to them. We're not doing anything about them. And so what Care Violence does is it hires people who are from the community, who are credible, who get information because people in the community share information with them about, you know, who's doing what, who did something last night. And so then they can go in that community and they can work with that individual to try to discourage them from actually carrying through with the violence that they're planning. And so really, we're using a lot of the information that is just going untapped. And I think, you know, cities across the country that aren't implementing this model, it's really a failure of imagination of what is possible. I think we see communities that have been violent for a long time, for decades, and we just think that that's the way it is, and that's the way that we have to get used to it. But it's a failure of imagination to not realize that communities can change and that they can go a year or 2 years without a shooting. And imagining what that would do for the entire city, if Charlotte can go from 100 down to 50 homicides, what would that do for the city? And I think when we do that sort of thing, when we realize that that's possible, that's when we can make these sort of big changes that we need to make in the approach to how we stop violence.
Charlie Ransford has alluded several times, Malcolm Graham, to sending qualified people with credibility into these communities. To work with the people most prone to violence. In Charlotte, we've had programs like this. They're small and they're grassroots programs, but that's what we're talking about. The people that run them have street cred. They know the people. They themselves, in some cases, were violent and transformed their lives, and now they're going in and saying, look, there's another way to do this to people who need that help. How is what we're doing now different from what Charlie Ransford's talking about, what Cure Violence is talking about?
I think we need to enhance it, right? I think right now we need to change the gas in our car in terms of working with grassroots organizations from regular to premium and put more of a focus on it. Last year,
does that mean giving them money, helping them find more people to do what they do?
It means identifying those individuals who are in the community, grassroots organizations, providing them resources and support necessary for them to be effective and efficient. Robert Dawkins does a great job in terms of working with grassroots organizations.
Yeah, and I've talked to Robert, and I've talked to some other people who do this, and one of the themes is that because they don't have a PhD and because they don't have credibility with the power brokers, let's put it that they have street cred and they're effective in the community, but to get the funding that they need, they complain about not having the credibility with power brokers and no way to prove that they're spending the money responsibly, even though
I made a commitment to Robert that I want to be his champion in the halls of city government. I instructed the mayor as well as the city, not instructed the mayor, I asked the mayor and the city manager that when they are meeting with the county and the chairman of the county commission, that we need grassroots leadership in those meetings as well. It's a combination of providing city services, county services, and resources, and working with those individuals in the community who know the community better than we do, and providing them the resources. Now, there'll be checks and balances. We're not going to just give money away. But when you have a successful organization or individuals like a Robert Dawkins, you need to invest in that individual. He knows who's doing what, where, when, why, and to what effect. And I want to support him and his organizations and others like him.
It's hard to prove a negative. And where Robert Dawkins and others have gone into the community, they probably have prevented violence. They probably have prevented homicides from occurring. We just don't know because you can't prove that there was going to be one or that would have happened in the absence of those folks working. How do you gauge success? And where there has been success, what seems to be working?
Well, I think you gauge success, and obviously, again, what we're doing is data-driven, right? So we're kind of relying on the data to kind of help us lead and steer us into making appropriate decisions. I think that's appropriate. I think this anecdotal type of success that you can't measure, but you got to do. You got to have boots on the ground. You got to have people walking those neighborhoods. And so it may not be as measurable as the number of deaths, right? That's
right.
Real tangible. But I think we know that these are measures that we have to take and steps along the way.
And you stress, Charlie, that these people that go into the community and work with these individuals who are perhaps prone to violence, they have to be known in the community. As you go around the country and around the world working on the Cure Violence program, where do you find these people? How do you recruit these people? How do you train these people?
Yeah, well, the identifying and recruiting, it turns out to be fairly easy. We go into a community such as Charlotte, and we introduce the program through our assessment process to the community, and we have people coming up to us saying, you know, either I'd love to work for your program, I think I'm qualified, or people saying, I know somebody who has to work for you. He has so much credibility and he can really make a difference. And so it's actually a fairly easy process of identifying. The training, you talk about a lot of great programs in Charlotte that are doing similar types of work, and we find this in every city we go to. And these are likely going to be the organizations that would implement the Cure Violence model. They'd get the funding to implement the model, and you know, the vast majority of the funding would stay local in Charlotte. And I think the difference is in the training and in specifically working with the people most likely to be violent. When you get into a community with violence, you encounter people that have a huge variety of problems that you could be helping. People that have drug problems, people that really need a job, people that are encountering hunger and other problems. And it's easy to get distracted and to help people that really need help. But if you want to drop violence, you really have to use specific techniques and training to focus in on the people most likely to be violent and spend all of your time on that. And that's how you really decrease violence. And so we have a 40-hour initial training for each worker. And then we have booster trainings every few months where we're coming back into Charlotte and we're trying to take whatever it is that's happened in the last few months and train up the workers on some new skills that they'll need to deal with that. Right. So it's a continual process where we get them up to speed and ready, and then we're constantly reacting to what's happening in the community to equip our workers to be able to do the job that they need to do.
I have to ask you, I know you're localizing it, and you're using the word Charlotte a lot because you're talking to people in Charlotte from Grand Rapids, but are you coming to Charlotte? Is Cure Violence going to be launching a program here?
You know, we have had conversations with people in Charlotte. There's definitely people that are interested in the Cure Violence approach in Charlotte. I don't think things are far enough along for me to make any announcements. Okay. I'd prefer to leave that locally to people to make any sense.
You know, one of the things that we, as a takeaway of our council meeting, was that our public safety committee is going back and they're going to identify best practices throughout the country to see what we should be bringing to Charlotte. Certainly Cure Violence, from my perspective, based on this conversation and the research I did prior to coming here, should be a likely candidate to kind of come to Charlotte and talk about what they're doing, how they can implement other practices. We're also working with Cities United, which is a mayor's organization that focuses on strategic resource for disrupting community violence and homicide. So there are a number of initiatives that we're looking at, and that's coming through our Public Safety Committee. A
couple of comments that have come in from listeners while we've been talking here, Denise, on Facebook regarding Myers Park residents. We are affected by violence and social issues outside our neighborhood, home burglaries, car thefts, etc. As responsible citizens, we should all be concerned about the needs of our Charlotte neighbors. Everyone's life has worth and value regardless of where they live. And Julie Iselt, the mayor pro tem, city council at large, Julie Iselt responding on Twitter. She said, responding to the question connecting violence on Beatty's Ford Road or other neighborhoods to Myers Park or Ballantyne, someone once told me, quote, crime that works in your neighborhood lives in mine, end quote. Some studies, doctors, suggest that long-term follow-up care is needed. It's a possible component for reducing recurring violence. Once a person gets out of the hospital, they need help. Is that a feasible option given already stressed resources and the cost of those resources?
Yes. You know, earlier we've talked about the financial investment that is required. There are a number of cities across the country that have initiated what we call hospital-based violence intervention programs. And so just like Cure Violence, we know that a patient who comes in with a gunshot wound is more likely to be re-injured or more likely to actually be a violent perpetrator. And so if we have them in our hospital for 4 or 5 days taking care of their injuries, is this a teachable moment that we can work with them, find out what factors cause them to be shot, stabbed, whatever it is, and begin a process of working with them to reduce their chances?
Are they receptive to that in the hospital bed?
Some are. For some people, we can get into some other discussions, but when we talk about youth violence specifically, a lot of these youth believe that they're invincible.
Yeah.
And when they get shot and they have an operation, they have a scar, they begin to perhaps say, well, maybe this is not what I should be doing. But there's not necessarily a structure in place to help them say, how can I change this? It was education, right, whether it's GED, whether it's drugs, whatever it is, there's a myriad usually of problems that have coalesced to get that patient to the point where he's been shot or stabbed. And so we believe that this is a teachable moment and that we should be putting resources into that patient at that time.
When Cure Violence sends people into neighborhoods in advance of violence, maybe, and also even after violence, what are you saying to people? How do you get their attention? How do you get them to listen? What are you saying?
Well, for the people that are approaching them, I think they have a history that they can draw on. And that history is, first of all, it's, you know, I've been where you've been. I understand what you're going through. Sometimes it's, hey, look, I was doing what you were doing, and I had to spend 20 years in jail for it, and you don't want to be like me. And so sometimes it's just being that example of being able to say, I totally understand where you're coming from, but think of it this way. And then, you know, there's also the element of if a worker happens to have grown up in the community that he's working in, which oftentimes is the case, they can say, hey, I know your mother, or I know your uncle, or I know your brother, and how would they feel about what you're doing right now? Or think about this person who you love and what they would think. Or you know, they could just use those connections to say, you know, hey, I know your friend so-and-so. Let me go get this person. Let's talk to you about what you're thinking about doing so we can talk you out of it. So a lot of it is just, you know, using your history, using your experience as a person, using your relationships and your network to kind of get at a person and get them to think about it. But then there's also a whole slew of techniques. You could get a person to just kind of stop and cool down for a minute. You can get them maybe to stop the violence. If you can get a person to think of something different, you can maybe question their thinking in a way to get them to stop the violence. So there's a number of techniques to do it.
Comment on Twitter: why do we continue to ignore the single most common factor in homes that produce violent offenders, the lack of a father? Do you think that's true? It's certainly a factor. Is it the only factor?
I think
even the most important factor.
Well, I think it could be one, but certainly the home environment plays a significant role in terms of upbringing of an individual, that role model actually in the house. Notwithstanding that, there are a number of organizations in the Charlotte community really doing a great job through mentoring and working with families and especially Black boys in our community. And so obviously having two parents in a household would be better than one. But
there are economic factors.
There's economic factors.
Over-incarceration factors.
There are a number of factors.
Lack of trust, lack of stake in society.
Number of factors.
A comment on Twitter: the violent crime stats I'm seeing for the West Garfield Park neighborhood in Chicago seem to be dramatically increasing in recent years, putting it near the top of the list for one of the most violent neighborhoods in Chicago. Is that what you're seeing? What's going on there? Is that true, Charlie?
So, I mean, I don't know how much time we have, but the history of Chicago is basically we had programming in West Garfield Park from 2000 to 2015. In March 2015, our funding was completely zeroed out. It was a problem between the governor and the state legislature. And we had zero violence prevention activity in West Garfield Park in 2015, 2016. And then it started to come back at the end of 2017. And so that increase, yes, it shot up. When you take out this kind of life-saving services, this kind of interruption, yeah, then violence can shoot up because then you, again, have an out-of-control epidemic and it shoots right back up.
I have 15 seconds. Kurt Putney, our chief of police here, said this is a marathon. This is going to take 10 years to solve. It's not going to be overnight. But in Chicago, in your program, they experienced a 48% reduction in shootings in the first week. If we applied your principles here, what do you think? How much time do you think it would take for us to reduce our crime rate in 10 seconds or less?
It's a matter of coverage. If you can get citywide coverage, we can drop homicides and shootings by 40, 50%. And we've done it in many cities around the country.
Charlie Ransford, Senior Director of Science and Policy at Cure Violence Global, Dr. David Jacobs, Medical and Trauma Services and a Trauma Surgeon at Atrium Health, and Malcolm Graham, representing District 2 on Charlotte City Council. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.